Hey, I'm Brian Hyatt, and this is Rolling Stone Music Now. So in every issue of Rolling Stone magazine, we have a feature called The Last Word. It runs in the back page, and it's a chance to get some wisdom from some of the most famous people in music and more. In a recent edition of The Last Word, Andy Green spoke with Sammy Hagar, and we're going to play that interview in a couple minutes. And we also have Andy Green in the studio right now. Hey, Andy.
Hey there, Brian. How you doing?
Besides Sammy, what are some of the favorite Last Word interviews you've done? You've done a bunch of them.
Yeah, I've done a bunch. I did Stephen King. That was a lot of fun. He's just so funny and so smart. He was really into the whole thing.
Did he have any music comments? He's a big Springsteen fan, and Mellencamp, he worked with Mellencamp.
Yeah, when I talked to him one time, he went on and on about how much he loves The River by Bruce Springsteen. That's one of his favorite lyrics. He was really good about that.
Is a dream a lie if it don't come true, or is it something worse? Something worse is like it. What are the other ones?
I spoke to Carrie Fisher 3 or so weeks before she passed away, and we talked about her death in it, and it was intense then, but afterwards it got really intense.
Yeah, it ended up getting a lot of attention. That was one of those weird things. It's a good interview. People should look that up.
Thank you.
And then, so Sammy, you have actually a relationship with Sammy Hagar.
Yeah, I interviewed Sammy at least 12 times or so through the years.
And every time you ask him about the status of his relationship with the Van Halen brothers.
Yeah, which is the first thing that he says to me now when he calls me up. When I answer the phone and it's Sammy, he goes, Andy Green, are you going to force me to talk this time about Van Halen? And I'm like, yes, I am.
It's pretty much the same answer every time, although now I think it's evolved slightly, right?
He changes it a little bit each time, but he's always very willing to talk about it, which is funny. It's a band he's been out of for 13 years. It's very awkward. It's a painful part of his life in some ways. He hasn't talked to Eddie in 13 years, but he's so willing to just go there. He does not care, which was part of what makes him so special, is that he doesn't give a shit.
Right. His autobiography is really, really great, in part because it's such a sort of vicious tell-all about Eddie Van Halen in particular. And I have to say, I think both of us have a soft spot for Sammy Hagar, who is one of the most maligned frontmen in the history of rock and roll or any genre. The very term Van Hagar like signifies garbage to a lot of people. And admittedly, there were a lot of songs with the word love in them that kind of blend together. And I don't know, there's like a million. I don't care what you say. Yeah.
Frustrating is they've erased him from their history. When they tour with Dave, they act like the band existed from 70 whatever until 84 and then again in 07. There's no acknowledgement that there was a Sammy Hagar.
But there was a Sammy Hagar. There's some guy you speak to frequently. Yes. And yes. I once did a story, and weirdly, it's one of my favorite stories. I did a story on the band Chickenfoot, which was a super group of Sammy Hagar, Joe Satriani.
And also Michael Anthony. And Chad
from the Chili Peppers, who really does look just like Will Ferrell, and for a man who was already middle-aged, acted like an absolute lunatic through the entire reporting of the story. And I will say that, I rarely care about being invited to the after party or whatever. Mm-hmm. The only thing I really wanted to go to is at the end of this long day I spent with Chickenfoot, Mario Batali, because Sammy's deeply in the food world. You talk about this a little bit. Sammy's a real foodie. And Mario Batali was going to invite them back to one of his restaurants and cook for them after hours, and that was the only thing I wanted to go to. And of course, they were like, see you later.
No.
But Sammy's a really nice guy, and I always think also about when Van Halen was inducted into the Hall of Fame, and he was one of the only people who showed up, and they did People Have the Power, and there was a moment when the vocals went from him to Patti Smith, and he said, you know what, he sang his ass off. Like, let Sammy Hagar be on that stage.
He was next to Eddie Vedder and Michael Stipe, and it was awesome. And the one bummer about Chickenfoot is when they toured, they couldn't do Van Halen songs because they didn't want to make Joe Satriani play Eddie's parts. But his current band is Sammy Hagar and The Circle, where it's like Michael Anthony on bass from Van Halen and Jason Bonham on drums from Led Zeppelin. So they do Van Hagar songs, they do Zeppelin songs. It's a really cool show.
And Sammy has a lot of money and maybe a tiny bit of an inferiority complex because people diss him. He once complained to you he never gets to play Bonnaroo, he never gets to play Coachella, he doesn't quite get why, you know?
Yeah, it's sort of frustrating to be Sammy Hagar in some ways. He's had so much success, but he doesn't get asked to play anywhere or anything. You know, he's forced to play casinos a lot. It just bums him out, I think. Though this summer, he's playing Sheds with Sammy Hagar and The Circle.
And in this interview, he kind of gets at that a little bit, the frustration of, like, the heat coming off you as you age and enter a certain place in pop culture. I'm sure there's a whole generation who's not quite sure who he is, actually.
Yeah, and he's very honest about that. He's very honest that he's way past the peak of his fame, and he only has a few years left, because he's much older than people realize. He turns 70 really soon.
Are you trying to talk us out of playing this interview?
No, I love him. I adore Sammy Hagar. He's the funniest guy in the world. I think him and Noel Gallagher are my two favorite people to talk to on the phone.
So at the beginning of this interview, what do you ask him about? Where do you get into?
I start asking him about the best part of success and the worst part of success.
All right, so let's get right into it. Here's Andy Green and Sammy Hagar.
All right, so let's start simple. Can you tell me the best part of success and the worst part of success?
Wow, I almost don't think there is a worst part. The best part of success is that you get to have a dream, and then success is when you accomplish it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the best thing for anyone to do when that happens is now live it. You know, a lot of people get their dreams and then they're disappointed. It's not what they expected, or they thought there was more to it. And of course, all that is part of it. It's not what you would expect, probably, but live that dream, and it will make you happier than chasing another one too soon. You know, you can always have another dream, but anyway. So that's the best part of success, is that you just get to live the dream you always wanted to.
Yeah.
The only downside, maybe, is that someday, you know, you're not as relevant as you were,
mm-hmm.
and that's where I'm at in my life now. I'm not having a hard time with it, but there's times when I go, wow. It's, you know, it's kind of like you see it winding down, you know. It's like I'm not going to have a big hit record. I'm not going to be this relevant, the hottest rock star in the world kind of guy probably ever again, and I don't expect to be, but I mean, it's just a little kind of like, now what am I going to do? I'm just going to get old and die, you know? So that's kind of a letdown, you know? It's like some people can't deal with that, as you can see.
So when you see a young rock star that's complaining, I'm sick of the pictures of me, I'm sick of all the attention, I'm sick of all I just want to be normal again. I want to be left alone. Do you have any sympathy for that?
No. It's like, well, guess what? Just keep that shit up, and it won't be, and it'll be gone pretty soon anyway.
Right.
And then you're probably going to go, well, damn, you know, where'd it go? Where'd you had it back?
Yeah.
You know, the workload of the climb can be tough, you know, especially when you got to go out on tour, if you got a family and all that. So, you know, there's some things that are kind of, man, I'm kind of tired of this, but we'll take a break, you know. That's right. What I always do.
So tell me the important rules you live by.
Oh, treat people the way you want to be treated.
Mm-hmm.
Keep your finger on where you started,
uh-huh.
and don't ever lose sight of that.
Mm-hmm.
And
and
I don't know, family over fame and fortune.
Mm-hmm. And so, why is keeping your finger on where you came from so important?
Because you forget who you are, and you always gotta know who you are, and people that get too caught up in the fame and fortune thing and think they're better than other people and think they're better than the people where they came from, and even it can come right down to your family members. You can turn your family members off because all of a sudden they look at you like you're a different person. You think you are who you are, you know what I mean, and what you've accomplished, to where that's just a thing that happens, that maybe you got real lucky and something, you got struck by lightning. But truth of the matter is, that will serve you really well if you keep your finger where you started, and then you go all the way to here, and now if you stretch your arms out from there to there and you measure that, that's how big you really are. You know, you've really, you know, grown and accomplished, and you can be whole. But if you're only who you are where you are now, that's just a little dot, and that's not very big, and that's not lasting, and that won't serve you well. So,
all right. So yeah. Tell me the best advice you ever got.
Well, probably treat other people the way you want to be treated. You know, we're in the hospitality business here, you know. Mm-hmm. Entertainers, you know?
Yeah.
And whether it's my restaurants or it's my, you know, other, you know, my spirits industry stuff or my walking out on stage, the idea is that you are in the hospitality business. You are there if you make people happy, and that's how you can have a long career like I've had, you know? If you piss people off and you're even a great big star, you're going to piss them off, and eventually they're going to say, you know what, I don't like that guy anymore. You know, people start growing up and say, man, you know, fuck that guy, right?
Yeah.
And so longevity is all about treating people right and doing the right thing every time you step in front of people that paid money to see you or bought your product or came into your restaurant or whatever. So I think treat people the way you want to be treated is a good one. I don't know. That's
yeah.
just some really good advice.
So when someone like Axl Rose starts the show at like midnight when the ticket says 8, I mean, that's not how he would want to be treated at a concert. I mean, it's
no, he'd be pissed off.
Yeah.
He'd be the first guy to leave.
Right.
He'd be the first guy out the door probably. But he's doing pretty good, so I hate using him as an example because,
right.
you know, Guns N' Roses is one of the, you know, biggest bands in the world right now.
Right.
They're still going out there and still so valid. It's
right.
shocking that they've got away with that. But when they do deliver, they deliver.
Right.
And so that's probably what's kind of
so
saved his ass.
When Kanye West stops his show after 2 songs and then rants about politics for half an hour and then just storms off.
Ah, wrong.
Yeah.
Strike 2.
Yeah, that's a very bad plan.
Yeah, that's the other advice that my manager Ed Leffler gave me was at one time when I was right before Van Halen, he said, "I'm never gonna, you know, let you be the press darling. You know, like if everyone really liked you and they really want you to be on the cover of every magazine and be the you know the darling of the year," he said, "I would stop it. I wouldn't let you do it.
Why?
Because he said that." Once you're really in and really like that, then you can only be less than that the next year. You'll be out. He goes, you know, if you're never in, you're never out.
Yeah.
So I never tried for all that, being the biggest star on the planet kind of thing, you know?
Yeah, because...
And just stay on cruise control under the radar. I like that.
Yeah, because a huge, huge, huge pop star, they come to personify, like, their moment in time. They're forever attached to like an era. Then when that era ends, they're sort of seen as passé. That can happen. So,
yeah.
Well,
I've kind of skated pretty clean underneath the radar pretty
right.
well, and it wasn't intentional all the time because a lot of times the press didn't give a shit about me either.
Right.
But my manager, kind of Ed Leffler, who also managed Van Halen through my whole career, time in there, he believed in that.
Right.
You know, he would keep you out of the press as much
yeah.
as possible. He, a lot of times, I'd say, why are we paying this publicist all this money? He'd say, to tell people no.
So, who are your heroes and why?
Well, Elvis, man. And Elvis, I just think, was the biggest rock star of all time.
Mm-hmm.
And
so why
Paul
is he your hero?
Newman.
Well, we should just talk a bit about Elvis here. So, why is he your hero?
Well, he was just so charismatic. I mean, I don't know. He was a great singer, especially early on,
yeah.
and he was such a unique fashion statement. I mean, when you look at pictures of this guy when he was starting out, I mean, he was a trip, man. He was dressing far out for the days, you know. And I mean, people wanted to beat him up and stuff, you know. I mean, and he was, and I don't know. He was just such a solo leader, you know, like the Beatles were. Fantastic, but they were 4 guys that got away with what they were doing, and it was kind of, it seemed like it was a little more contrived, and every, you know, was people thought about it, you know, their Epstein kind of created it, you know,
right.
So Elvis created himself, man, and he was such a icon, and I don't know, just think he was just badass, even when he was, you know, all old and crazy and fat and doing all them crazy things, and I still loved him, man. I thought he was the king. I don't know.
It's sort of a tragedy, and he was surrounded by people that didn't really care about his well-being, and it killed him. I mean,
yeah, well, people, they might have cared about him. See, I think people cared about him a lot. Everyone, I think they really loved him.
Mm-hmm.
It just that he was he was a powerful guy, and they were afraid of him.
Right.
He, you know, we all know if you read towards how wacky he got towards the end. I mean, he'd beat your ass, pull a gun, and pull it at your head, man,
yeah.
in the middle of a dinner. You know, it'd be like, whoa.
Right.
So I think they were just afraid to tell him and do anything to really help him, and they were just, I don't know. He was always breaking the mold and breaking, you know, the rules about the whole business, you know. So
and he was just 42 when he died. It's unreal.
Unreal. That just blows my mind.
Yeah.
He seemed like such an old legend, you know,
right.
at 42.
And so why is Paul Newman your hero also?
Well, I just think he just always did the right thing, you know. That whole charity thing that he dared and mm-hmm. stuck with it. And I just saw him speak one time not long before he died, and he was talking about philanthropy, and he had a profound influence on me as much as Elvis Presley did, mm-hmm. as much as the Stones did, and me as a person, by saying, he was talking about how when you're in a position to be able to help others, less fortunate people, whether it's feed them or house them or, you know, just help them out with medical problems or whatever, he goes, if you're in a position to do that, and you see someone that needs it, a situation, and you can do something about it, and you don't, it's like, I don't know. He just said, you know, basically, I couldn't live with that. He goes, you know, once I saw it and knew I could help, then you have to do it. It's just part of, you know, and I just thought it was just so cool. The way he said it hit me like, holy shit, I better start looking around, because I don't want to have to someday go, man, what did you do for anybody? You know what I mean?
Right.
So it changed my life and put me on a trail of seeing what I can do to help other people. And my two biggest things are feeding people. Number one, the simplest thing you can do. Food banks all over the country, they're awesome. You give them a dollar, they can make three meals out of it. It's, you know, and the cool thing about food banks is that there's people now, many of them, it's not just about a homeless, you know, a person that's, you know, street, lives in the street. It's about families that work, husband, mother, whatever, they work. They got three or four kids. They can't make ends meet. But on that month where they say, well, this month I got to pay the insurance bill or I got to pay the rent or whatever it is, and they're short with food, they can go down the food bank and collect food and eat. And I just think that that's pretty awesome, because when I go on tour, I give money to every town I play for the last 9 years I've been doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And I go down to the food bank sometimes on a day off to give them the check and to hand out food, because I want to see what's going on. And I see so many families now, clean-cut people drive up in their car, and all the kids, and they get out, and they fill up their bags, and they go home, and they give them really good food. I mean, vegetables and stuff, so... boy, that one's a big one for me. And then when I can, I like to help children or families that have a terminally ill child that have run out of medical.
Yeah.
That is the saddest thing on the planet.
Yeah.
So to me. But it's so damn expensive that I help maybe one or two people like that a year is all I can afford with my... I do it with my restaurant business.
Right.
So
tell me the music that still moves you the most.
Blues.
Blues?
So R&B, you know, old R&B, Otis Redding,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, and then you listen to John Lee Hooker or Lightning Hopkins or Jimmy Reed,
mm-hmm.
listen to James Brown. Oh, fuck. I got goosebumps on my whole body just now. It's just saying his name, because last night I was watching my Access TV show, and they showed an ad. They got a James Brown special coming up, and seeing that bad mother... fucking hit that stage and start dancing and giving it up and screaming and hitting the leading the band, going down on his knees, back up, splits, back up. Man, there was nobody better than James Brown.
Right.
I mean, he is the man.
Yeah, I think he was very ahead of his time. That people back then, they couldn't even fully comprehend just what was happening. It was so overwhelming. And
he invented the shit, too. Just think about that, what he was playing. He said, I've read every book and done everything, you know, because I just studied the guy, because he was, God, I mean, he was so illiterate, but he knew how to get it done somehow. A little tough guy to work with, I guess, but when you read his book, when you read his horn player's book, what was that guy's name, the trombone player. When you read his book, it makes you not like James Brown anymore until you see him again. And on TV, you see a performance like the Tammy Show or something. And then you go, fuck that guy. James is a bad mother.
Right.
But he said every instrument was a drum. So you playing guitar, you're playing a drum beat. You're playing, bam, 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 bam. You know, you're not playing like a guitar, man.
Yeah.
Every instrument was a drum, and it's fucking amazing.
And he was mean to the band.
Oh.
But they were so afraid of him that he got results. I mean,
yeah, he got results. The tightest band in history, man.
Right,
ever.
Yeah, because they'd be charging money if they'd won. If they were off by one half second, they would.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That was probably his way of just saving money too. Every now and then, say, yeah, I only got a couple extra, but I can't afford to pay the band, so I'm going to fine him.
So
fuck, man. That still inspires me and still just warms my heart, man.
So tell me your favorite city in the whole world.
Oh, favorite city?
Yeah.
Whew. Wow, that's really a tough one. Florence.
Why?
It's just so artsy and great restaurants and just great ambience and all the, you know, I could say Rome or Paris and all that because they all have all the same thing, but I just like the ambience of Florence. I wouldn't call Sardinia the Costa Smeralta area up there. I wouldn't call that a city, but that area might be my favorite area in the world.
Right.
But just for a city, I'd go to Florence every time I had a chance.
All right, so tell me the advice about the music industry that you wish that somebody gave you back when you started.
Oh, man, to be yourself. Totally be yourself. Stop copying other people. Don't be looking at trying to sing like some other guy or trying to sing like Mick Jagger or Otis Redding or anybody. I mean, I guess you got to do that.
Yeah.
But, like, hear what you want to sound like in your head and hear the kind of music you want to play. Hear it in your head and just start trying to do that.
How about advice about the business side of the music business that you wish that you'd gotten back when you started?
No, I'm cool with all that.
Really?
I think if I would have made it overnight, like my first album would have exploded, and I would have been, you know, sold platinum and became a millionaire my first year in the business, that probably could have ruined me, but I'm not sure if anything could have ruined me because I'm driven like a son of a gun.
Yeah.
And if fame and fortune don't satisfy me. It's not like... that's what I'm really out for.
Mm-hmm.
There's something else that I get from success that's just, I don't know if anybody else gets it, but, you know, I don't know. I'm very, very driven to do things and accomplish things. I like the accomplishment. Probably if I'd have been, wouldn't have been what I am, I think I probably could have been an athlete because I'm competitive with myself. You know, I'm always pushing myself and say, well, you know what, I wonder if I could do that. You know, just like a keep pushing on my TV show because I'm in love with having my own TV show. I'm loving this to death. And I just had dinner with Mark Cuban night before last, and we shook hands. No, I want your third season, fourth season. You know, like, I'm loving this show. You're doing it, killing it for us, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Wow.
And I said to myself, a couple of years ago, I'm going, what do we want to do? And I woke up and said, you know, I think I want to try a TV, you know?
Wow.
Not acting, but a TV show, like a host of some kind, or... you know, create a show, and so I did, and it's successful, and I'm just loving it. It's rewarding. It's just like, wow, I actually pulled it off.
Oh, wow.
it's kind of cool. So I'm a little screwy like that, so I don't think I missed anything.
So tell me the most indulgent purchase that you've ever made in your whole life.
Oh, my fucking plane, man.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Like, what kind of plane?
A Bombardier Challenger 300.
And
it holds 9 people. It goes 7.5 hours in the air at 525 miles an hour. So it's very indulgent, and it's a huge luxury. It costs a lot, and it costs a lot to operate.
Uh-huh.
But without it, I couldn't do half the shit I do.
And how long ago did you get it?
This year will be my fourth year. I bought it for my birthday 4 years ago in October,
wow.
3.5 years ago. And, you know, it's one of those things. It was like... I can afford it.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't like, oh boy, you're really taking a chance here. But I feel kind of guilty, you know, spending that much money on something for myself because I'm at a point in my life where I don't care about doing that much for myself, mm-hmm. and it's more about doing for others. You get a lot more out of that. And,
right.
But now that I've done it, see, I realize I can say, oh, I can just, if I had to jump on a commercial flight 2 days ago to go to Dallas to meet with Mark Cuban,
yeah.
I wouldn't have went.
Right.
I said, fuck you, I ain't coming. You know? But and same with touring, you know, same with, you know, going out on tour. If I had to be on
right.
bus and commercial flights, and, you know, I couldn't tour the way I do. I can jump from East Coast to West Coast. It don't matter. So
right.
It allows me to spend more time with my family and spend more time on creative things. So it's a great project. I met Warren Buffett about 5 years ago,
mm-hmm.
Before I bought this plane. I was flying NetJets. I was doing charters, but it wasn't my plane. So he asked me to speak at his summit, for his GE summit he has for all of his 1,000 CEOs and presidents of all his companies. And so I spoke, and we were talking about things, about how, you know, he had a hole in his shoe. He had two different socks on.
Yeah.
He was just totally walking around with a six-pack of Cherry Coke and his fucking hand under his arm. And just a down-home guy that has no luxuries, but he said his only luxury is that he has a plane. Uh-huh. And he told me that. I didn't ask no question. We were just talking, you know, what do you call a luxury? And he said, to be able to accomplish what I can accomplish, I have to be able to get on my plane and leave when I want and get there when I want and all, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And he said, that's the only luxury I have. And
yeah.
I said, wow. And I said, fuck it, bought my plane.
Yeah, but
that's pretty good advice. He also told me, said, hey, so Warren, if I, you know, have a few a few hundred thousand bucks and I wanted to make some money with it, what would you do? I said, give a guy some advice here. And he's going, well, reach in your pocket and pull the money, whatever you have out, and fold it in half. He just doubles your money. What a prick, huh?
Yeah, God. Yeah, but the cost of the fuel alone on a plane has got to be insane sometimes, right?
Yeah, it is. But, you know, I fly my whole family around, and I fly my band around.
Oh, yeah.
And I fill it up. So it's comparable with commercial, except we get there on time, and we'd have to wait in line. You don't have to go leave 4 hours early.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? So the time savings and all that, to me, equals out. And like I say, my philanthropy's gotten to the point where it's very generous right now, and has been for 9 years. And so I feel pretty good about what I do for other people. And
no,
so
of course.
That's my only luxury.
I got it.
And in this clip, we begin with Andy asking Sammy about his fitness routine, because why not?
I wake up in the morning, and I do 50 push-ups, and I do 100 crunches next to my bed, and then I stretch myself out good.
Wow.
And that's been going on for a long time. And my wife and I, we walk all over the place, man. It's like I used to run. I can't really run much anymore. I don't want to kill my ankles and knees because I've had no replacements, thank God, because I've been a runner my whole life.
Mm-hmm.
So now we just kind of hike uphill. We live in the mountains, or when we're in Cabo or Hawaii, we walk on the beach. A lot. Like in Cabo, we wake up in the morning, I do my thing. We'll maybe have a little coffee, a little breakfast, and then we go for a couple mile walk on the beach. We dig around in the rocks, you know, and find shells, and, you know, just have a outdoor thing. And then, you know, after dinner, or sometimes right before dinner, depends on how things are going, we do it again. And I just stay active. If I see an elevator and there's only three or four flights of stairs, I take the stairs.
Wow.
You know, that's the simplest thing you can do on the planet. And sometimes I skip a stair, you know, just for fun, just to show that my old ass can still do it.
So describe the best meal you've had your whole life.
Oh, fuck. Uh-huh. Oh, now you're killing me.
Sorry.
Well, I'm not sure I can think of one that was the absolute best, but I had a damn good meal in Seville, Spain, last summer. That was at a restaurant where they had just the Iberico ham that they had was just not like I've ever had in America anywhere. And then these Iberico pig cheeks that were grilled, and this kind of just a little mustard sauce the guy made, and I'm just trying to describe what, trying to remember everything that I had.
Wow.
And then we had just some kind of a, like a paella, but it wasn't like traditional paella. It was just a rice dish that was made with things, and I just, you know, ate about everything on the menu, just the way their bread was. Mm-hmm. Everything about that, the olive oil that they had, it was really a high-end restaurant. It was very expensive, and I had a 75 Vega Sicilia Unico with it, which is one of the greatest bottles of wine ever made, in my opinion. And that was pretty much when I left that place, you know, my wife and I, we just went, wow, that was a good meal. And
Do you know the name of the restaurant or anything?
No, hell okay. No. It was recommended by the person that's maitre d' at the hotel, and and it was super duper high end, probably too expensive. Even if I knew the name, probably wouldn't tell you because I wouldn't recommend anybody going there unless they had maybe 750 a person in their pocket, maybe more to do it. You know, but I'll say, but my favorite thing to eat, I think my favorite, you know, in my book, Are We Having Any Fun Yet, which is my kind of a lifestyle cookbook. Yeah. I said my last meal, I'm in prison. You know, they're gonna put me down. I would take osso buco, which is veal shank, braised veal shanks with the marrow in the middle, over linguine, not with risotto. I don't like the saffron risotto. I like linguine with a little bit more sauce so that it's kind of a little bit soupier than normal. Uh-huh. And not soupier, but, you know, a little bit less, more juicy. And with a great loaf of Italian bread. Uh-huh. And with probably an 85 Conterno Barolo.
Yeah,
would make me very happy. That would be.
Do you trust the prison to not screw that up?
No, I would make them. I'd say, hey, I want to cook it.
You know? Okay,
man, I got that recipe in my book. Are you kidding?
Yeah,
I'm a real gourmet chef. I could blow your mind, and people can't believe it when I have people come over. I've cooked for Emeril Lagasse. I've cooked for Mario Batali. Mm-hmm. I've cooked for Julian Serrano. Mm-hmm. You know, uppity chefs and. I blow their mind. Huh.
So your youngest kid is 16?
Yes, sir. And 2 weeks ago.
Did you teach her how to drive?
Oh yeah, she drives all over the place already. Mm-hmm. She grew up. We have two homes that have one has a in Cabo that has ATVs, you know, and you can ride them all over the beach. And so she grew up since she's 7, 8 years old driving ATVs. Mm-hmm. And in Hawaii we have a golf cart because it's a big property and it's got a little, you know, it's like a pickup truck golf cart, you know, for the gardener to use. Mm-hmm. And when my kids have been driving that thing forever, and so they learned hand and brake coordination, both my girls, and so they took to driving so well. The second we got behind the wheel in a big car, you know, and said, okay, we're gonna let you drive down this dirt road, or here we're gonna let you drive on this little side street. It was just mind-blowing. I'm going, wow, these kids, they really learned something.
Hi.
You know, it's like video games. People that play video games, you know, like guitar and all that.
Right.
And they pick up a guitar and they can damn near shred. You're going, how the hell did you learn that shit, you know?
Do you feel differently about speed limits if it's your daughter driving?
Nah, you know, that's a tough one. I care so much about my kids, something happened to them.
It could
crush me. But you know, I think you got to... When I'm driving, in the kind of cars I'm driving, if I'm driving my LaFerrari, for instance, the things it can do at 100 miles an hour, some big tractor trailer can't do at 5 miles an hour.
Right.
You know, it's safer. And so, I mean, I hate to say it like that, like I'm prejudiced, like, hey, I'm better than you. But no, my car is capable. And if you know how to drive, you're driving safer sometimes when you look like you're being reckless, and some guys are just cruising down the street at 30.
So describe your parenting style. Are you a stern dad? Are you a fun dad? What kind of dad are you?
Oh, I'm big fun.
Uh-huh.
But I wrestle my kids and tease my kids and goof off with my kids all the time. But I'm really stern. My wife and I, she's even more stern than me. We just don't take any nonsense. My kids aren't allowed to lie to me. You know, that's number one. Don't lie to me. Tell me the truth. And if you lie to me and I find out, you're going to get punished worse than if you just told me the truth and it was something that really pissed me off. But so I got this little policy with my kids, and that really matters. It really changes things. So they don't lie to me. So if they don't lie to me, then they're afraid to do things that they're going to have to tell me about. And it's a real interesting way to raise kids without having to use the iron fist. You have a rule. We don't lie in this house, you know, and we treat people the way we want to be treated. And so it's kind of like if you can embed that in them from a young age, you don't have to discipline them as much. Because like I said, my daughter, she just don't want to do anything. She's going to have to come home and tell me eventually. So it really helps. I mean, you know, but that's kind of our style. It's kind of like anything goes. You do what you want to do, but you're going to have to tell me about it. Because if I find out about it, oof, you know, they know, you know, we follow through. That's the other thing. Follow through. You threaten something, you better be prepared to do it, you know.
Huh. So how do you feel about turning 70 soon?
Fucking out of sight, man. Mm-hmm. You know, if I'd have thought when I was 30 that if things would be like this at 70, I wouldn't have been so worried about anything. Not that I was worried, but I mean, you know, sit there and say, gee, you know, you get insecure every now and then, go, wow, I wonder what I'm going to do when I'm 50, you know, or what am I going to do when I'm 60? Like, what if I, you know, have to do something? You know, you sit there and think, wow, what if I need to go back to work or something, and I can, you know, piece of cake, man. I can do anything at 70 that I can think of that I could do at 50 and maybe 40. You know, maybe not my 30s. I don't jump over fences, and like I said, I don't go, you know, running 8 mile run up the mountain and back, you know. But I don't know, I can sing as good, I play guitar as good, I'm functional, I'm, you know, I've had sex probably as much as I ever did, you know, and I don't know, I feel pretty good about 70. So I'm not sure. When I was growing up, my grandfather, when he was 70, he was fucking done. I look back and think, wow, I don't know. I don't know if he felt like I felt in his head or not, but he sure didn't look and act like it.
Right. Yeah, yeah. No, I've heard Howard Stern talk about how rich 70 is very different than poor 70.
Well... Yeah, no, I don't get it. How about if I say that about being 70? I don't get it. I really don't. I'm going, I don't know. It's like, you know, they say this, you know, you hear that silly shit, you know, 60s, the new...
40 or whatever.
Yeah, 40, yeah. Man, 70 is like, to me, still 40. Yeah. It's like, at 60, I felt a little bit... like not as limber as I normally been. Everybody's trying to tell me for the last 10 years. Oh, you got to take yoga. Got to do yoga. I can't fucking do yoga. That's the most boring thing in the world, other than the view in some of those yoga studios. But but I just can't get loose as much as I, you know, used to be. I can, you know, right. Just feel stiff. You know, wake up in the morning, feel stiff. So there you go. That's the only difference.
All right. So I think you've been married for about 22 years, right?
26.
Oh, wow, 26. So yep. Tell me the secret to a long marriage.
Being in love with your wife, or your mate, your partner. Without that, then it just becomes a kind of a complacent relationship, you know, just get into habits doing the same thing. I'll tell him, okay, you go your way, I'll go mine, all that. We do everything together, and I refuse to, you know, like ever have separate bedrooms or separate vacations. Man, that... To me, that's out. It's like, if you don't want to be with the person, then you really don't want to be with them. So, I don't know. It's we have our fights and disagreements and all shit like everybody else, but for some reason, I'm still in love with my wife, and I'm thinking she's still in love with me. She sure acts like it. And you know that joke about some people say, a little kid comes home from school and he says, hey, Daddy, I learned in school today that some people don't get to know their wives till after they're married, know who their wives, you know, are till after they're married. And Dad goes, Sonny, it's like that all over the world. Well, that ain't the case with me. My wife is the same damn person that I met and that I fell in love with. And she's growing up a little bit, you know, becoming a woman and saying, I want things this way and I want things that way, you know, not just riding on my rocket ship with me all the time.
Yeah.
And so, you know, okay, there you go. Now you roped me into it, figuring it out. Right. One of the keys to marriage is give and take. I mean, you have to give as much thought to what your partner wants as what you want. And especially with men that are successful, you know, and you think, hey, man, I tell my band what to do. I tell my manager what to do. I tell my employees what to do. And then you come home, well, don't try to tell your wife what to do. That shit don't work. their equal. And, right. Boy, there you go. That's the most important thing.
Yeah, it's like, okay.
That'll get you a lot of... That'll get you somewhere.
So the internet thinks that you are worth $120 million. That's what's online.
Mm-hmm.
So then, like, what do you... So do you understand why the super rich are despised by so many people? Now that you are among them, do you?
Oh, fuck. You know, there's some super rich people that deserve to be despised, and uh-huh. there are some poor people that deserve to be despised. I think it's all about how you live your life and how you treat other people. And there it goes right back down to the first question you asked me.
Yeah.
If you have money uh-huh. and you have the ability to help others that you know less fortunate, and whatever degree you want to do it, and whatever your pet peeve is about, if you do that, then no one should dislike you, because.
Yeah.
Rich people can do more for people than anyone, and if they do, then they should be, you know, they should be treated well for it and respected for it and not hated.
Yeah.
But, you know, somebody like Warren Buffett and Bill Gates, they give away billions of dollars to school. They build fucking schools, man, you know, and how could you hate a guy like that? You know, it's like, God bless you. So I think it just depends on what. With it, you know, some people just are just greedy, and I hate greed more than anything. I think people that make money with money, if you want to talk about money, I think that if you just make money with money, that's a shitty way to make money, and you will never have enough, and you will never feel it. You just make a transaction. Oh, I just made $250 million today in the stock market. Cool. You never even see it. You don't feel anything. You get this big ego rush, and. But when somebody walks out on stage and sings their ass off and fucking performs themselves into a tour, when they walk back, they're done, they're just laid down, and they've given it all, and they get paid well for that, well, that's one way to make money, and there's nothing wrong with that. And go out, I'd rather go out and dig a ditch with a shovel and say, just give me my money, and say, okay, I earned this money, I feel good about it, than to have... somebody just say, guess what, give me $5 and I'll give you 10 back, you know, and you put it on the table and you get 10 back, say, woo, you know.
Yeah.
You know, that's fun money, but it just, I...
It's hollow.
Yeah.
So do you think at all, about retirement out of music in like 5 years, 10 years, or do you just want to keep going forever? Do you think at all about stopping?
Oh, hell, I have no idea. You know, like I said, who would have thought I was at 70 years old, I'd be planning this big birthday bash in Mexico, in Cabo with... You know, I'm putting on a big festival this year, and we're, you know, going to have all these people come down and join me like they always do. But now it seems like everybody will be able to get in, get a ticket. You know, maybe if we get this thing done, we're trying to get a big outdoor festival thing going for my 70th. And I, when I was 30, I didn't think I would be singing when I was 50. Mm-hmm. And when I was 50, I didn't think I'd be singing when I was 70, that's for sure. So, as long as I can still sing and perform up to standard, up to my own standards, and certainly be competitive with my age group, that's for sure. I ain't worried about that, actually. I want to be competitive with the 30 to 40-year-olds.
Yeah.
So as long as I can do that, then I don't see any reason to stop, because it's really fun and cool. My fans love it. Never if I start feeling like I'm just doing it for the wrong reasons, like would be for just for money, which it's not, or just to keep my fans happy or something, but I wasn't enjoying it, I wouldn't do it. I'll just quit when I don't enjoy it anymore.
All right, and that charity show you're doing is a pretty amazing lineup with James Hetfield and all those people.
James can't make it this year, but it's filled up in 4 minutes, but Dave Grohl stepped in. You know, I'm always like to keep kind of like the same vibe. I like to have at least one female artist. I'd like to have two, but for some reason, female artists are the hardest ones to get. I don't know what it is about them. I guess it's because it's presented by Sammy Hagar and James Hetfield, and so the female artists go, I don't want to be with their guy, with their crowd. I don't want to walk out in front of them and tell me their crowd. But Sarah McLachlan this year, and like I say, Dave Grohl, Mick Fleetwood, Bob Weir, Steve Vai, Don Felder.
Wow.
Am I missing somebody? It's like it's eclectic as hell. Pat Benatar, Neil Giraldo,
It seems to build every year and get bigger and bigger. It's pretty amazing.
Well, because everyone that does it, they go around telling everybody how great it was because it's so much fun. You only have to play three songs acoustically,
right.
And then you end up coming out with other people, and it turns into an event that's not even planned. You know, it's like I don't say who's doing anything. It always takes a life of its own, and it's just if it wasn't for the Cobble Wobble, Andy, for me having to do this every year for my birthday, having all these crazy eclectic people, Kenny Chesney, Toby Keith, you know, Slash over here, you know, Vinnie Paul from Hell Yeah, Pantera, you know, it's like you're good, just trying to put all these people together. If it wasn't for all that experience, this thing would scare me to death. But I know how to do it now, and it's you just get a bunch of people in the room, and everybody starts goofing off and just say, hey, that sounds great. Why don't you guys do that, you know, or just walk out in the middle of James Hetfield's song and play the solo real quick. You know, Joe Satriani walks out and plays a solo, leaves. You know, it's just... it's something great, and I like what it's for.
In this next clip, Andy asks Sammy the question that he's asked Sammy maybe 11 times, but this time it gets a slightly different answer. It's about the prospects for a Van Halen reunion. Let's hear what he had to say.
Super quick. The last time you spoke to Eddie Van Halen in person, that was 04, was the last show of the tour?
Yeah, absolutely.
Wow.
The closest thing we had to a conversation was I wished him a happy birthday two years ago, and And I said, I hope you're doing good. He got back and said, I'm sure his publicist or his social media person probably did it, but with his blessings, I'm sure. And he said, hey, thank you. I hope you're doing well, too, or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, I see these stories on the internet about every 6 months about how there's secret plans for a big reunion tour with Sammy. It's always, like, talked about, but it always seems to be based off of nothing.
Yeah, it is with me.
Yeah.
I haven't talked to anyone. I'm not reaching out.
Okay.
I did my radio show. Did you see my radio show or hear about my radio show?
Yeah, when you made the set list, right?
Yeah, I said, here, this would be the ultimate Van Halen. I'm going to tell you, I'm going to tell you exactly what my dream would be. If I said, let's do this, here's the way I'm interested.
Okay.
You tell me you're interested in doing it this way, I'm there. I'll get on my plane, come straight down, sit at the table with you, and we'll discuss this and try to make it happen any way we can. And that would be Sam and Dave, Mike, Al, and Eddie.
Yes.
That's it. Wolfie's band, open, I don't care, whatever. Eddie, you can come out and play with Eddie during his solo. This is about the Van Halen that really matters, I think, you know, and it's that's the combination. And I would, instead of trying to do duets with Dave, I wouldn't even try to push that button. I'd say, no, Dave, you go out and play two songs, walk off the stage, I walk out, I'll do two songs, I'll walk off, you do two songs. Can you imagine the competition of that? Like, you know, Dave goes out and does Jump, Ain't Talking About Love, okay? What the fuck? I got to rock out there. I go, whew, shit, you know, right now, why can't this be love? Okay, great, you know, I mean, you get a set list like that going. I go out there and, you know, and then blow out, you know, something like you know, Good Enough, the opening track from 5150.
Yeah.
And then, you know, Dave's got to come out with Ain't Talking About Love. Now you better, you know, you got to hit it hard, and you better be good. You know what I mean? It's like, don't be just bullshitting your way through this. I think it would create the best Van Halen show that could possibly be done today. And I would be all for it, and I would give my money to food banks if they would do the same, if they'd match my funds. I'll do it any way they want to do it, and I would love to put that foreclosure on there and give the fans the greatest Van Halen show that could possibly happen today, and then say, okay, now I still don't like you guys.
Okay, so percent odds that happens?
I think it could happen in a second. I think there's so much money involved that somebody will make it happen. How about that?
Wow.
Because, you know, hey, the promoters, the managements, the t-shirt guys, you just name it.
Well, and
the vendors.
And like, Irvin Azoff is a pretty smart guy. You think
he's not a smart guy. He's the smartest guy.
He's the smartest guy, and he knows how to make money. So hopefully he can get through to Eddie and is like, just stop being a fool. Make this happen.
Yeah, I really think it's kind of inevitable. And if it doesn't happen, well, it's getting kind of late now. You know, it's like, if this doesn't happen, at least to get goal by next year, you know, I just don't think, hey, at 75, here I go saying, making predictions again. Yeah. At 75, I don't think I want to do a Van Halen reunion.
Right. But at 71, sure, yeah.
Exactly.
You've been listening to Andy Green and Sammy Hagar. Andy, final thoughts on that interview?
I think the reunion is probably not going to happen.
We'll see. We had a whole screaming match about that on another episode, and perhaps we will again. Anyway, so this has been today's Rolling Stone Music Now. We'll be back next week at 1 p.m. here on SiriusXM's Volume, Channel 106. In the meantime, download us as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts, subscribe to us as a podcast, and do us a favor and leave us a great review on iTunes. Have a great week, and we'll see you next time.